Hi, welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and co-host is Chris Lucian. And today, definitely excited to have Alan Stewart on the show. Got some good topics lined up. Software architecture, technical lifestyle changes, and talking about mobbing context. Before we jump into those, Alan, do you mind introducing yourself for the audience?
Sure. So I'm a software architect, or at least that's how I like to think of myself. I've been writing code for over 25 years. And just over time, I've gravitated towards architecture and principles and practices that help teams improve. That's part of how I got in learning about mobbing. It was probably 10 years ago, I first joined a team where they were mobbing exclusively. And I'd heard about pair programming before, but I'd always done pair programming in the kind of least effective, like, hey, you in the next cubicle, could you just come over here and like look over my shoulder, but like, I'm not gonna let you type, or vice versa. I go over there and they're doing all the typing and we're just like talking about it. But we started mob programming full time on that team and it was great. So I've given a couple talks about it. One of them, Woody Zuhl was present in the front row. And it was a little bit intimidating and surreal, probably for him too, because then I like one of my slides had a picture of him and a quote from him. So like very interesting, but it was fun and he was awesome. And just the final thing I'll point out as an introduction to me, a friend of mine, Mark Pearl, wrote this book, Wisdom with the Crowd. This might be as close as I've gotten to being published myself because I helped him review when he was in the editorial process. And so, yeah, my name's in the book. Maybe one day I will write my own book, but it is not this day.
Nice. Oh, that's some great background and experiences there. And yeah, we've had Mark on the show. So yeah, I'll link that. And so, but yeah, let's jump into it today. So software architecture, what are you thinking there? What brings this topic to mind for you?
Well, for one thing, it's something that I really enjoy, but I also think that it's a really applicable topic towards mob programming in general, right? This is a mob mentality show, so it kind of put me in mind of it because I think software architecture, when I look at it, and the more I've learned about it, I feel like it's a spectrum of things, right? It's not just this one thing that certain people with a title of architect do, but anybody who's writing code is affecting the architecture in some way, from little functions that you write, if you're designing a class or how you're going to like combine, some functions, if you're doing like a functional programming style. Are you going to do partially applied functions or are you going to do something else? Are you going to do dependency injection? All of these decisions are part of software architecture. And so everybody is participating in the architecture of a system. And it just depends on kind of what level of abstraction, what scale you want to look at. So at like kind of these high systems level, you might be talking about microservices and event brokers and how, messages travel through a system and, whether you've got traceability and concerns like that. But at the low level, everybody's participating in some way. And so I think it's a really interesting, at least I find it really interesting to consider how the architecture affects everyone. And also the architecture just generally is part of how you get a business result from the code that you're creating, right? If we look at it from a Conway's Law perspective, then architecture is design. So the people matter, how the people communicate. It's all part of this bigger socio-technical system.
How does mobbing affect your architecture and or is it the inverse? Is it mobs participating in an overall architecture? Like how does that play into it?
Yeah, I think probably both ways, right? One of the things that I've really enjoyed about mob programming is the consistency. that you get across a team, right? So you start to build up kind of the conventions of what, of how you do things. You can enforce some of those things with like linters or StyleCop or, you know, a program like that, but just even how people approach a problem, so they start to converge in interesting ways with mobbing that I think brings a consistency to a code base. And that helps the architecture stay cleaner. It helps, and cleaner architectures are easier to change. And so you can try things, you can experiment with people's ideas. You can learn from each other. Like, there's definitely been many times when I've been sitting down with a mob and there'd be somebody who has some expertise on a particular topic. And so it's like, so we kind of leapfrog ahead because of what they've done, what they're bringing to the table. And we're like, oh, wow, I did not know that interesting esoteric detail about, you know, some framework, but somebody else had, because they had run into it before, they had experienced it. And so when it comes back to the architecture, I think you're getting that more consistent communication throughout the team, throughout the people, of how are we going to build this? How is it going to affect us? And then that in turn leads to hopefully better business outcomes for what you're trying to accomplish.
Nice. Yeah. And I think for me personally, I've had quite a bit of experience influencing the architecture of a system, whether it's, like you said, at the higher levels, the moderate levels, or the lower levels, as a mob. But what's something that jumps out to me is that you described yourself as an architect, right? As like your job title. And so how does that work with mobbing? Is it like there's a team and they're working on something and you join them? Or like, you know, how does that relationship work as an architect in mobbing, I guess?
Yeah, so I think it just depends. Usually when I'm mobbing, I consider myself part of the team, right? There's different schools of thought about what software architecture is and whether like the whole term is misappropriated anyway, or things like that. But I think about software architecture in basically, or as far as if you are thinking about yourself as an architect, the kind of where I draw the delineation between just coding and doing the architect work is around three things: communication, business value, and systems thinking. Those kind of broadly line up with, you know, categories of things that I found. And so when I'm working with a team, I like to think about myself as being there on the team, and I'm just contributing to what they're doing. There have been a couple times where I've been in like dedicated architect roles where I'm not actually like a full-time member of a team, but I'll come and join with the mob. And it's very nice that it's very flexible, right? It's a very easy way to jump in with a team. And I like to kind of just sit back and try not to take over too much. I definitely can have a little bit of control freak tendencies sometimes. StrengthsFinder would call those deliberative and responsible, but I know that the dark side of it is that I take over. So I try to avoid that and say, hey, how am I here to help you? And bringing some of those concepts of what an architect brings to business and see how I can add that, help the team, you know, observe that. And then there's other times where I am a member of the team, and thinking like an architect means that I need to think about things like the business value. Like, what are we trying to achieve for the business? How much time do we need to spend on technical things so that we don't slow down in the long haul, so we can stay sustainable? And how often do we need to make decisions that make better sense for the business, and we're not just like padding our resumes with cool technology or something like that?
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, and it reminds me the two flows you talked about. I haven't seen it with that title before, but I've seen it with other titles, like people who are more specialists, or you know, their t-shirt sizing, or their t-shirt specialty is
T
one
size,
thing.
yes.
T-shirt sizing,
T versus M versus I, right?
But with other yeah, exactly, Chris. Yeah, but other specialties like I've seen it with database or kind of infrastructure as code and infrastructure, someone who is either part of a mob full time, or they float between mobs, or security, or things like that. And so I guess it's interesting to think about it from an architecture perspective. Always bringing that. Yeah, so thanks for sharing on that. And what do you mentioned the different levels of abstraction. When you join a team as an architect, where do you go to first? You know, are you low level, medium level, high level, or you know, how does that interaction go?
I guess like all programming questions, it depends. Depends on what the team is doing and so forth. I do like to jump in at the low level and help out with like everything from, you know, because it is, it's all architecture, right? And they're influencing the work that I do as an architect, just by the way that they write their code. So jumping in and helping out with, you know, just whatever feature is being built, whatever problem is being built. But I do tend to think up at that kind of higher level of abstraction. And it depends on what the system looks like. But for example, when I was working on at a company where we had a lot of microservices, then I would come in, and one of the things that I could bring to the table was an understanding of how is your service going to interact with other services. Because when they're working for themselves, we were trying to do the thing where you create autonomous teams that can, you know, deliver value independently. And so when it comes to what they do, their team, they're the specialist in that area. But then I can help bring understanding of like, okay, well, now you're going to have to interact for this new feature that you're building. You're going to have to interact with this new team that you haven't really interacted with before. Let's consider some of the ways that these interactions are going to work. How's that going to play out as far as being in a distributed system? And do we need to have everything run synchronously? What things can be eventually consistent? What things can change on some of those other, I guess, some of these other aspects that the team by themselves wouldn't normally think about because that's not their specialty. They're focused on delivering value in a particular subset of the product. And then I would bring in kind of a broader understanding. It's like, okay, well, when I worked with this other team before, they had a similar problem, and let me explain to you what they did, and we can see if it fits into your context. Or no, you're trying to borrow what this third team did, and that doesn't work for you because some other thing that can often be a fresh perspective that that the team doesn't have because that's not what they're doing day to day.
Like a cross-pollinating bumblebee.
Yeah.
Bring the pollen from flower to flower.
Nice. Yeah, and I think there's something really admirable about an architect who I mean, you've probably seen the videos online, or you think of the architect meme from The Matrix. You know, it's like the guy sitting with all the screens behind them who would architect everything. You know, jumping in with the team about like method or class or module level design might feel like too lowly, like for this ivory tower person, right? You know, and so I think there's something really probably winsome too to a team, to if someone comes in with that, you know, either that skill or that title, who's like willing to roll up the sleeves, pick up a shovel, and help them dig, you know. And the truth is, in my experience, like you said, it's all architecture, right? So if the little pieces aren't done well, it makes it hard to do the high level pieces well, right? And so
Absolutely.
yeah, each piece matters. Yeah, I suppose it would go poorly if you're like, oh, I see you guys are just doing boilerplate. I'll come back in an hour when you're doing something important, you know, or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the thing, right? It is all architecture. And so I think of architect as more of a role. It's something that you can learn to play as you understand software better and better, as you understand different systems and you get experience. But it's not a, I don't know, it's not like an elevation of privilege, you know. You haven't reached the nobility and now everyone else is a serf below you. But in fact, the best architects that I know do regularly get down and they're in the code. And probably the worst experience that I can ever remember with an architect that was definitely that ivory tower flavor. It was not fun for me as a developer at my point in my career. He had designed like a database schema and said, okay, these are how these tables should work for this thing that you're going to build. And he had very much done it in the ivory tower way of, I thought about it. I've handed down the tablets. You just need to go and code them and do them. And we found a couple of problems. We're like, this isn't going to work well in a couple specific instances. And he just didn't want to hear it. He didn't care. He wasn't incentivized to change anything about, you know, his glorious design. And so ultimately we just ignored his design and fixed the problems that weren't going to work. And so I think if you're going to have a architect title, you got to decide whether, like, how much humility you're going to apply to yourself, because that's going to really impact how people react to you, you know, whether they're going to actually listen to anything that you say, or if they're just going to, you know, do the proper observances until you leave and then ignore you and be on their way.
Yeah, it makes me even wonder and imagine, like, I can imagine myself, if I'm given a high level architecture that doesn't work, making a low level adapter pattern to adapt like the things that work to the pattern that doesn't, so that we don't get in trouble, you know, or something. Which is kind of funny that the, you know, you have to like apply architecture to get out of bad architecture or something. But, yeah, humility is a big thing. And oh, you were gonna say something, Chris? I'm sorry.
Oh no, this all kind of has me thinking about the like everyone draws architecture. And so I like this idea of the entire team independently drawing out what they think the architecture would be and then comparing notes afterwards. And that's another way to kind of level the playing field and also incorporate others' ideas and make it kind of like a we did this together rather than like that person did it. And I think all of those things, you know, any like power dichotomy that you have, it doesn't matter what it is, you need to find styles of collaboration that incorporate, I think the ability for people to give their input and be heard and then sift through ideas and then come out with something at the end. And also you have to be okay with like not having your idea be the idea that was chosen, that sort of thing. So I think those are important in the sense of how you look at those things. And so I do like that idea of the almost the cross-pollinator architect a lot. So
I've done a couple of those exercises, like you're describing. Everybody draws the system, and inevitably, everybody brings something interesting to the table, right? Somebody will remember a detail that somebody else didn't know. We did one time where our product manager wanted to jump in, and she oftentimes wouldn't participate in some of the other like developer practices that we were doing, but she jumped in on this one, and we were doing like draw the system, and her drawing of the system was extremely valuable in like revealing how she thought about it. And it's like, oh, well, I tend to think about it in terms of things like database and service and, you know, Ajax calls or, you know, stuff like that. And it's like, oh, well, she didn't think about that at all.
Yep, yep, yep. For sure, for sure. Well, that might be a good, yeah, I think, I guess one thought on that is, involving the business in the architecture will lead to it being a more domain, right, in the architecture, which it seems to be a win for everybody. But I guess in light of time, it might be good to switch topics here. So what do you mean by technical lifestyle changes? Do you mind jumping into that, Alan?
Yeah. So I have found it very common across the industry as I've jumped from job to job, and also as I've done a little bit of dabbling in consulting with companies who are just looking for some advice, for some help, that a company wants different outcomes and they don't know how to get to it. And they want to wave the magic wand, right? So like, I'm thinking, you know, maybe 15 years ago, all the rage was agile. You just have to go and get your Scrum certification, and it's going to wave this magic agile pixie dust on your business, and you're going to get better. But it didn't really work for a lot of companies, and so I call it technical lifestyle changes, because I feel like it's a lot like your health lifestyle changes, right? So if you want a different outcome for yourself, because he's like, oh, I want to, you know, lose a little bit of weight, or I want to build up muscle for the next race that I'm going to go on, or you know, I just want to eat healthier and live longer, you're going to have to make some changes, right? It's all too easy for us to say, okay, great, January 1, I'm going to hit the gym and, you know, I'm going to hit the gym real hard, and for 6 weeks, it's going to be amazing, and I'm going to eat really well. But you can't just do that once and say, okay, well, I did my time, you know. 3 years ago, I went to the gym, so where are the benefits?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I find myself almost feeling like I'm more like a lifestyle coach than a technical person at times, just because there are things that you have to change, and these are socio-technical things. So it's not just, oh, well, your PHP is out of date and you got to update that. But it's, how do you interact with the developers on your team, right? What is your software developer development lifecycle look like? How, you know, are you just like farming out tasks and just saying, hey, I'm the CEO, and whatever I feel like doing today is, that's the ticket that goes into Jira and they're going to build it? Or do you have, you know, various processes? Do you apply concepts like high cohesion and low coupling, or do you test drive your code? All of those kinds of things really impact how you work, right? And some of them are much more for the developers, right? So like doing test-driven development might really impact the way that a developer looks at coding, especially if they haven't done much unit testing, let alone test driving before. But it also affects the business, right? Like how much capacity of your team are you going to dedicate towards keeping the system in a healthy state? Because you can't just do that once. You can't just say, we'll invest 2 months into a big project and then assume that after that, everything's just going to maintain itself, because it's not. And, you know, entropy hits these systems just as hard as it hits our bodies. And you have to change how you think about approaching your software business just as much as you do like adopting a particular framework or practice.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I think we've interacted with the community a couple times on kind of like why hasn't good things caught on? And one of the favorite answers I got back from the community is like, well, why hasn't diet and good exercise caught on, you know?
Exactly.
And it's like the same human problem, right? That you know, that it's sometimes it's an awareness problem, but sometimes it's what you're talking about, right? You know, there's a goal. I'm aware of a better thing. I have a goal for the better thing, but I'm not doing it. You know what? Why? What's going on there? So, how do you help people overcome that as you put on your life coach hat, your lifestyle coach hat? What are your go-tos there?
it's tough. You know, there's a lot of reasons why people don't want to change, right? And there's just kind of built-in inertia. But honestly, part of the reason that I call it that I think about it that way now is because communicating that up front has helped a lot, because it helps set the expectations of, well, what do you want to achieve? There was a company that I was working for. When I started, the first couple months, I didn't end up doing very much feature coding, because I saw that there were a lot of foundational things that I felt like we could improve. We could improve the dependency injection on this system. We could make some updates to some older libraries and just kind of quality of life improvements. And the product manager on that team, he told me later, after I'd been there probably like a year or so, he said that like the first 3 or 4 months that I'd been working, he was unsure about me, because he felt like no product work was being done, or at least not being done by me. And, you know, is this really going to work out? But over time, what he had noticed is more product work, more feature work had been accomplished over like the last 6 months than the prior 6 months before I had started. So even though, and I did eventually jump in and I was working more on feature stuff, because there were some directives from the CTO. Part of the reason he brought me in was to help with these quality of life things. Like, he had just barely gotten continuous integration and a deployment pipeline set up. And he's like, I don't want to backpedal on these things. We've got to move forward. So there was reason for it. And I think when you start to observe those things, and having seen it over multiple different companies, you know, the patterns that emerge, you know, socio-technical patterns that emerge, then I start looking at it and say, okay, here, let's set those expectations. Let me help you understand that this is a lifestyle change. We're going to change how we work to get different outcomes. And then it's just a matter of picking, you know, what is the thing that you're going to improve? In some ways, it almost doesn't matter what it is that you're going to improve. There's usually some bottleneck that they're really upset about, and so you can focus on the bottleneck. But getting that habit of continual improvement, like continual retrospective, is probably more important than any individual task that you complete, because you start to see the benefits.
How do you go about instilling that habit? Is it just, hey, let's start doing retrospectives and having action items? Or is it something more subtle than that? You know, or is it just, what's your biggest bottleneck? Let's fix that. And then what's your next biggest bottleneck? Let's fix that. Like, how do you go about bringing people along with you?
I think everyone is a little bit different, right? So each experience has been different, because buy-in matters a lot, because if people aren't interested or invested in it, then it doesn't go very well. So like the example I shared just a minute ago, the CTO, he was a friend of mine. And so he was already bought in, that he wanted things to improve. And so in that case, it was nice, because had a lot of top-down support, right? It's like, this is a directive. And so it's an appeal to authority, right? It's like, oh, well, you know, the CTO, he says, we got to do these things now. Other times, I've been on teams where it's been more like grassroots change, where we say, hey, wouldn't we like to improve? Wouldn't we like to not suffer through a, a particular pain point that we've been suffering through? And so that finding that thing that they're interested in, right? So at more executive levels, they're more interested, they tend to be interested in things like, well, how is this going to help us build features or deliver the customer value or save us some money on our Amazon bill or something like that. And with the individual software developers, they have different pain points, right? They have different reasons why they would want to get involved, why they would want to care. And so, finding those, figuring out what is it that is appealing and why you want to be invested. Because, I can lead you to water, but I can't force you to drink.
Nice. Yeah. I think you're right. Finding that already existing motivation, right? I've noticed, I've been coaching a lot of kids sports lately, and that's something, at least that I'm not good at creating with someone, is like, oh, you're not motivated? Let me create some motivation for you or something. But if someone has motivation for something, that fuel can lead to a lot of good things, right? I guess, have you ever come across situations where there's a complete lack of a complete lack of motivation or apathy?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot you can do with that. I do think that thinking about people as a design constraint, like going back to the kind of architecture concept, there are some interesting things that you can do there. Mm. Right. So like, what is the makeup of a team? And, what are they interested in? Or like even things like hiring pools, right? Like if it's more likely that a particular company is going to be hiring a lot of, junior or mid-level developers, well, maybe your architecture should support that. Right. If you're expecting them all to be, geniuses that have experience, like if they haven't sat down with Sam Newman and actually wrote their own microservices with him, if that's like the level that you need them at, then you're going to be throwing them into a situation that they're just unable to work through. Right. Like it's unfair. Right. It's like, It's just a bad expectation on your part to try and throw them into a big software mess and assume that they're going to be able to do it. Mm. So I think that that's an interesting place where you can look at ways to motivate people where you might shift around the architecture, right? So like maybe there's more standardization that is needed on a certain team, or on a different team, they need a lot more liberty to explore and try new tech and do things, because that starts to build up the motivation and they say, oh yeah, I can be excited about this. I want to come to work because we're doing something that is interesting and happy. So that's kind of how I think about that, because like you said, it's hard to motivate people if they're not motivated. And sometimes that happens. There are people I've worked with that just really just wanted to get to the weekend and get their paycheck, and that's what they cared about. And they didn't care about Solid. They didn't care about unit testing. And it didn't matter how many times the CTO said, you need to be unit testing. They weren't able to find that thing that kind of intrinsically motivated them. And so it never happened.
Nice. Well, in light of time, maybe it's related to this as well. You had on here as a topic, mobbing context. What do you mean by that?
So I like to think about things in terms of the context of applicability, right? So we think about that hopefully with our software design patterns, right? Is this a good time to use, say, strategy pattern? Because if you just go around saying, oh man, strategy pattern is awesome, or I've got a friend who he told me once that once he learned about decorator pattern, he's just like decorating every single class that he wrote. But that's not always the right thing to do, right? There's a context of applicability. And I think I've been thinking about mobbing and its context of applicability for a little while now, because I'm currently working at a startup. And for a while, there were only two developers, me and a friend of mine. And we were doing mobbing because we had worked together previously. And so we were just mobbing all the time. And we were getting a little bit of pressure. It's like, oh, you know, couldn't we just start on something else? And we would tell him about lean and why, you know, we want to keep our work in process low and we want to finish things, not start things. But ultimately, a guy I know said that reducing work in process isn't a goal, right? It's like, it's not an end to itself. Releasing or increasing the flow of value is what you want to do. And so on this team, we decided that, I mean, I guess we were just pairing, not really mobbing. There was only two of us, but we were in that mindset of, you know, constant collaboration, and decided that, you know what, for a while, we're going to stop and we're going to work solo. And there were trade-offs with that. I think it mostly worked pretty well. We're right now, we're kind of back to doing part-time mobbing just because our context changed. But that's really kind of what I think about with mobbing contexts is this the right thing for you to be doing right now? What are you getting out of it? I love the little graphic that Llewellyn Falco made. I think it was him, or at least it was on his website for a while, where it talks about, like, it's got a bunch of different curves. It's like, sometimes I'm good, sometimes I'm not. And, you know, the best and the worst of me is getting into the code. But when you're mob programming, you're taking the best of everybody, right? And you're trying to, like, get rid of those lows. Well, in the code base we were working in, you know, my low and my friend's low were still pretty high compared to the average quality of the rest of the code. And so we felt pretty confident. It's like, we've worked together. We have a very similar style. We know how we would solve these kinds of problems. And so we just broke it up and said, okay, we're going to not mob for a while. But how do we keep some of those things that we really like? So like when we did code reviews, we didn't say, okay, well, we're not mobbing, so here's a pull request. No, we stayed on Zoom all day and still talked with each other all day. But we just like have a mini pairing session whenever somebody had something to code review, or, hey, I'm stuck on this, or I've got a question about, you know, naming this variable, even little things like that. Just like, yeah. Speak up. Let's take care of it. Let's get the fast feedback and move on.
Yeah, exactly. And I was reading Amy Edmondson's two books, Teaming and then Teaming to Innovate. And I was trying to remember what exactly she said, but it was something about that when uncertainty is high and interdependency is high as well, right? So like Chris knows a thing that I don't know to get the thing done, and I know a thing he doesn't know, and then let's say Alan knows a thing that neither Chris or I know, and that's a higher interdependency. That's when teaming is the biggest wins, right? Also when the uncertainty is high, right? So I suppose if you're in a context where the certainty is really high and you got it all in your head, then you're a mob of one. I guess you have different parts of your brain mobbing with yourself or something, right? and like you sure. said, there's still trade-offs. It's not like a complete knockout win. There's always trade-offs one way or the other. But and I don't think it's too much of a surprise. I'm interested in Chris's critique or thoughts on this, that mobbing was born in a space that was fairly complex. You got firmware, you got hardware, you got multiple domains, you got, you know, web, you got cloud, you know, I mean, you got lots of, you know, things going on. It wasn't like, mobbing wasn't born in making the millionth version of an e-commerce website or something, right? Or, you know, so not to say that those things aren't hard, because they get really hard, but it was a clear case of there was a lot going on and a lot of different expertise. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, Chris?
Well, you know, so it's kind of evolved over the years, but the, you know, so I think in our context right now with the mobs that we have, you know, it's like mobbing is not required, but if you're not contributing and you're not learning, go to a different mob, right? So in the case of a pair of two extremely senior people, if they're, you know, if one person is not contributing and not learning, then their time, you know, or the percentage of time where they're not contributing or learning is high, then splitting may be the right thing to do. And then the alternative I offer to people often when they're thinking about splitting in this way is automation. So it's like, if it's something that's so simple, or you have to do it over and over again, just in a lot of different places, then it's like, how do we write a script to do that? And so, yeah, so it's like, if you're not learning, you're not contributing, go to a different mob. If the work is so simple that a mob feels like it's a waste of time, also consider what it would be to automate all of the work. And so I was in a mob recently, and they were migrating from an old DI platform to a new one. And everybody was like, oh, we got to go and change all these files. And I was just in the mob, and somebody else there was like, I bet Chris has a good way to automate this. And so then, you know, sure enough, we went into, we started up a Python script, and then I asked Copilot, I wrote in the comments, you know, search all the C# files in this document and do this and do that, and update it from this framework to another. And then it wrote a whole bunch of Python code. We cleaned up a few things and then ran it, and then it completed all of the work. And so, in that case, it was like people were learning and contributing, and you automated all of the work. So even though doing one of them took a lot longer than it would have, doing all of them took a fraction of the time it would have. So, so those are kind of my rules of thumb in that area.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I think it's so important that you're thinking about that, right? Because it's never as simple as what you see on the face of it, right? And I think anybody who's done very much with pair or ensemble programming has seen this, right? The outsider or executive that comes in and sees, well, there's four people, but only one of them is typing. How could this possibly be efficient? And, you know, so we learned some things about lean and actually delivering value and how knowledge work is different than assembly line work. But it's easy then to turn that into the new dogma and say, oh, yeah, well, obviously then we should always be mobbing all the time, you know, inflexibly. It's like, no. The wonderful thing about mobbing is that it is very flexible. And yeah, you do that really annoying little task. And sometimes we would get into one of the teams I was on, like some CSS work. It's like, this is easy. Any one of us could do it. But the overhead of splitting up, and now the rest of the team is going to be working on a new thing, and like they're learning and they're gaining knowledge, and there's an absent person that could be contributing to that. It's like, well, look, let's just all spend the 10 minutes and we'll get the CSS done.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's so stupid and simple that we can just do it. And it's surprising also how often when it's a, you know, mundane task, you make stupid mistakes that having that second pair of eyes saying, did you actually mean that? That's not how you flexbox. Oh yeah, that's not how you flexbox.
Well, also, like in the CSS example, I think, you know, somebody might, you know, very elegantly style a button, but not think about how that style affects all the other buttons. And so there's probably some higher level thinking that can happen as a mob, that wouldn't be considered by an individual. And it's so that that's a lot of the benefit, you know, a lot of it is focused on the long term.
Yeah, I'll shout out one more thing. I know you got to close it down, Chris, but I will give a shout out to, you didn't call it this, but I've heard it called this before, the parallel programming, Alan, where you're not, you know, sharing the same keyboard, but you're like on the same call or in the same room and just kind of talking as you do stuff. I've loved doing that, especially when the R&D is, when the uncertainty is really high, you can get lots of experiments going if people are comfortable with that kind of that style, and yeah, you get lots of rapid experimentation. So I've had a lot of joy doing that, breaking into that mode sometimes. So yeah.
It might be the asymmetric exploration pattern or something.
Yeah. Know. Oh wow, you come with a fancy name.
Yeah. No, I think about that a lot, because in those scenarios, I think, especially when it's totally unknown, often it's much more expensive to have a whole mob learn a path that isn't going to work. And so if if you can prove out four independent ways of how something isn't going to work and then merge that, then that parallel, you know, the asymmetric exploration on the same call is probably much more valuable than mobbing. Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, in the spirit of time here, Alan, do you have anything that you want to plug or share before we close it down?
I'll plug the Utah Software Craftsmanship Group. I live in Utah, so I got involved with them a number of years ago. My schedule is such right now that I haven't attended a lot of their meetings for a while, but it's been a big support to me, and it's been just a fun group of people to work with. So if you're interested in mobbing, you're interested in you know, some of these other concepts that we've talked about, I feel like that's a great place that you can go to learn more. So if you're in Utah, if you're not in Utah, they have been doing them virtually. And I know some people from Atlanta and some other places have been joining in. So you can go to utahsc.org to learn more.
All right. And to our audience, if you know anybody that made a New Year's resolution around giving up the hamburgers of estimation and the French fries of waterfall and want to get back into new lifestyle habits, then please share this episode with them. And, you know, leave comments in the chat. That always helps us as well. Like and subscribe. Ring the notification bell. Thanks for listening. And again, Alan, thank you for being on the show with us. And to our audience, have a good one. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
See ya.